It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 68 for Friday the 23rd of March, 2012. On the show today, the Pirate Bay wants to escape legal troubles by hosting its BitTorrent servers on unmanned drones 50 kilometres in the sky. Fair enough, guys. MIT has been developing a new type of camera system that allows photographers to literally capture images from around corners. And how much would you pay to go to Mars? Private space firm SpaceX has a figure, and it's not quite as expensive as you might think. All that and more coming up. Ahoy, ahoy, hoy, hoy.
That was a mega ahoy.
That was a good ahoy. Sorry. Ahoy there. Yes. Nate Langston here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
We are still sans Duncan Gear because he's out gallivanting in, where is he? Texas.
Galloping. In Austin, Texas.
Of course. Oh, we had the most, probably the weirdest bit of fan imagery come in last night. Someone drew the entire podcast team as My Little Pony horses. They're actually quite accurate.
They are
accurate.
Amazing. I'm not sure he drew them. I think repurposed some that were from other forums, but they were amazing.
Pony infringement. Yeah, they called it the Wired.co.uk Hoofcast. I think we should be a Hoofcast from now on.
I've been calling it Hoofcast all day. I'm all for it.
I'm all for it. But anyway, we'll get on with some news. Now, the Pirate Bay wants to send, basically, unmanned drones 50 kilometres above the sky to host their BitTorrent servers on. And the idea here is that they could be completely away from any kind of jurisdiction, legal problems. And it's an experiment that they've announced officially on their blog. Now, this sounds to me a little bit like when they tried to buy the little island platform of Sealand, which is somewhere near Suffolk, I think, in the North Sea a few years ago.
And that never happened, did it?
It never happened. They tried to raise some money to buy this little, I think it was an old oil rig, actually, that exists off the coast of Suffolk. And they thought that if they could host their servers there, they would be away from the sort of legal problems that they suffer by basically hosting torrent files. And this feels like an extension of that thought process. And on their blog, Mr. Spock posted, "We're going to experiment with sending up some small drones that will float some kilometers up in the air. This way, our machines will have to be shot down with aeroplanes in order to shut down our system. A real act of war." Liv, these are strong words.
Those are strong words. How high up do you have to go in order to be outside of the jurisdiction of the country below the drones?
Well, that's the thing. They want to go 50 kilometres up. My first thought was, okay, well, good luck flying over British airspace or any airspace, really, because they're going to shoot you down, you know, unidentified unmanned drones. But they're going to do it as an experiment, and they want to do it with really cheap equipment. So having a central processing unit like the Raspberry Pi that we've seen, which costs, you know, about 20 quid, these super cheap components, it shouldn't be too expensive to launch some of these drones. Whether or not it works or not is another question. I mean, the Pirate Bay, as a bit of background, has stopped using torrent files and started using these magnet links, which is where the data that you get in a torrent file is basically stored in the same way the data that you're trying to download is. So you have to connect to some users, and the users themselves give you the torrent file, and then the torrent file connects you to the users that host the files you're trying to download. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So these drones will be hosting basically redirects that will redirect you to the people who are hosting magnet links, essentially. That wasn't specified so much on the blog, but that's probably the way it would work.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting idea. I mean, it's probably not going to work. I'm not holding my my hooves. I'm not crossing my hooves, Liv.
No, but if I think the ambition is good and admirable.
They're nothing but ambitious. So we'll follow that closely, and perhaps with a camera that can see around corners, Liv. MIT's been up to some stuff.
They have indeed. MIT are always getting up to stuff, aren't they?
And things.
All sorts of things. A team of researchers at MIT have developed a camera that can see round corners. And it does this by bouncing off a burst of laser light off walls and doors. And this then reflects back. And based on the data that they get back, they can kind of build up a picture of what was inside a room.
So it's a little bit like how ultrasound works. When you fire ultrasound at a at a pregnant lady, but you know what I mean. The way that they can build up the image inside the womb, I think it's a little bit like that.
It is very much like that in terms of you're bouncing some waves off objects and then working out what the object looks like from the reflection of those waves. Mm. However, the kind of difference here is, I guess, that it's round a corner. The camera, it can be behind a wall, and it can, and the light can be, the laser light can be bounced off at an angle, and then so that it goes into the room that's hidden. Mm. And then the data that bounces off can be kind of transcribed back into an image, which is interesting.
Yeah, the Kinect, Microsoft's Xbox Kinect, uses a similar system with infrared to determine the 3D image, so it knows the shape of the room, and if you use an Xbox, you can sort of see a weird kind of black and white infrared interpretation of your room actually on screen. And but it's, you know, it's very fuzzy, it's very hazy. You're not going to be, you know, we're not going to be using these on Vogue, right?
On Vogue.
Well, we wouldn't. But, you know,
no.
We're not going to be photographing. David Bailey's not.
Oh, I see. Yes. No, we're not going to be photographing models using this. But what they could be used for is things like emergency responders trying to see behind, you know, I don't know, in war zones potentially, or, you know, behind very difficult places to access. And also for vehicle navigation, possibly to negotiate blind corners.
This is probably not something we're going to see in consumer electronics anytime soon. It's
no.
a research project.
It's very much research.
But we've seen another sort of interesting thing I just wanted to talk about, because we've not really mentioned this, the Lytro cameras. Mm. Have you seen these? It's kind of, it's a whole new type of photography where the camera, rather than taking, you know, rather than you focusing on an image, taking the picture and being able to edit things like exposure and, you know, shadows, left shadows, things like that afterwards in Photoshop or Aperture or something. What this actually does is it records the direction of light and it records everything in a scene, so you can actually change the focal point after you've taken the picture. So you could just hold the camera up at any angle and just roughly frame the shot, and you could, you know, you can actually manipulate whether the foreground's in focus or the background, or you know, a bit on a wall or something, which is a really cool bit of technology.
So the skill kind of moves from the actual process of taking the photo to the kind of editing it afterwards and working out how you want it to look.
In a way, yeah. I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of like a posh RAW image.
Yeah.
You know, a RAW file that comes out of a camera is just data straight from the camera's sensor. So you actually have to process the image rather than produce a JPEG, which the camera processes from the RAW itself.
But you don't get that kind of, you can choose where the depth of field is and get that kind of lovely blurry effect.
On the Lytro.
On the Lytro.
On the Lytro, you can change that afterwards. Yeah. So I just wanted to mention it because it's just another cool bit of technology that people are developing that's really kind of thinking a bit differently about how photography might be evolving rather than just bigger sensors and better lenses and stuff.
But Lytro, you can buy, can't you?
Oh, you can buy that actually now. Yeah, it's a consumer product. So I think it's about $400 or something.
Yeah.
But it's one of those technologies that'll probably get licensed by Canon or Sony or someone like that and end up being part of you know, a future camera system rather than be a standalone product itself.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's enough cameras. Let's talk about mammoths.
Let's.
Now, we've talked about this before, the mammoths coming back.
We have. I can't remember how long ago it was, but a mammoth bone, a really well-preserved thigh bone, was discovered in Siberia. And a Korean biotech company has just done a deal with the people who found the mammoth bone. I think it was the province of Siberia where it was discovered, to take some of the bone marrow that was preserved within it and to try and create embryos with mammoth DNA that could be implanted into elephants.
This was the same company, wasn't it, that did that cloned dog a few years ago?
Yes, this company has got some kind of good track record with cloning things. They created the world's first clone dog, Snuppy, in 2005.
Interesting.
So it's not just a kind of a joker of a company.
What I'm curious about, though, and I always think this about when it comes to bringing things back from the dead, is why a mammoth? I mean, what does a mammoth... I mean, we sort of talked about this in our little pre-show chat.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, why not? You know, mammoths are cool. And I'm thinking there's got to be something more useful we can bring back than a mammoth.
I'm sure you're right. But I think the challenge is also finding the stem cells that are preserved well enough to be able to clone them and create, you know, these resurrect these animals. But yes, in some ways there could be cooler creatures that you could play with.
Mm. What would you bring back?
I'd really like Jurassic Park to happen, you know?
To happen?
Yes.
You want an island full of recreated dinosaurs that run amok and eat men
maybe not the full plot, but you know what I mean? Bringing back dinosaurs, I think, would be freaking awesome. I would love to ride a Diplodocus down Whitehall to work, leave it tethered outside the office.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
Would you stop at red lights on the back of a Diplodocus?
I would actually. I stop on my bike. I just hang out, chill out.
I chew cyclists who don't stop at red lights.
You do what?
I would chew them
if
I had a dinosaur.
Absolutely.
I would chew them.
What would you bring back?
I would bring back the probably the saber-toothed tiger. I think that's a pretty cool looking beast.
Some hole punching.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty cool beast. What beast would you bring back? Podcast at wired.co.uk. So we've got an interesting story here called about something called the Free Universal Construction Kit. And you may notice the acronym there is FUCK. This is a piece of, I don't know if it's open source or whatever, but it's a kind of people have reverse engineered Lego bits, bits of Kinects, you know, those little kind of sticks that you can clip into stuff, a bit like Meccano. They've reverse engineered these different blocks by scanning them. And scanning them into a computer and then producing bits where essentially you've got a Kinects rod poking out of the side of a Lego piece, or you've got some Kinects poking out of Duplo.
Yeah.
So you can connect Lego bits to Kinect bits. And they've done this with 3D printing. So you can download the sort of little 3D drawings from a website, Thingiverse, and then you can, if you've got access to a 3D printer, or you own a 3D printer, if you're one of those crazy kids, then you can print out these reverse engineered Lego parts.
So it's kind of like the plug adapters that you have, but for Lego and other sorts of building blocks.
I mean, think about it. You could, if you wanted to build, say, I don't know, a massive Lego house, and you thought, you know what would be cool about this Lego house? It would be if I could put a Kinect Ferris wheel on the top. But of course, you need certain pieces that would allow you to mount that Ferris wheel on the top of your Lego house. So what you need is a reverse engineered Lego piece that connects to the appropriate Kinect piece that you can 3D print out and connect your Ferris wheel to your Lego house. And they reckon that they can get around legal stuff by legal problems by saying that it's basically it's fair use.
I think I'm not sure about the legal standpoint, but I think that's a really cool idea.
It's a great idea. I mean, they said kids don't care about copyright. They just want to be able to construct cool things. And while I think that is correct, I think Lego may have something to say on the reverse engineering of their
bricks. It's a hybrid product that spans both sorts. It's kind of like the ridiculous, what do you get, those connectors that connect any Canon lens to an iPhone. It's kind of like that, isn't it? It's playing that kind of intermediate role.
It is in a way. I think the difference is that in that example, that would be an adapter.
Yeah.
So you can get them, you know, for putting old discontinued lenses on new cameras that have different types of lens mounts. Whereas this is more about actually creating the bricks. So it'd be more like you're creating a Canon
hybrid
lens. Yeah, it's a hybrid.
A Canon lens with an end that works on a Nikon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, what's quite ironic about this is that I think, and I'm totally going off my notes here, but I think that Kinects once pitched their product to the Lego guys before they went on sale and said, do you want to buy us or do you want to buy this?
And
Lego turned them down.
Oh,
I have no notes to that end in front of me, but I've got a feeling that that's true. Anyway, if you want to download these things, if you have a 3D printer and want to print some of these out, then go to our story. If you search for Free Universal Construction Kit, you will find a link to the Thingiverse site and you can download these. And let us know if you do. We're going to take a quick break now anyway, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the UK's super fast broadband being neither super nor fast.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Now, the UK has been lagging a bit in the broadband speed wars versus other countries. And there was a conference. Was it a conference recently, Liv? Or?
It was a hearing in the House of Lords.
That has said that basically our broadband plans are not ambitious enough and it's going to keep us in some sort of industrial dark age.
Exactly. This was a hearing that in the House of Lords, and they had Peter Cochrane, I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, who is the former CTO of BT, addressing the House of Lords about his concerns about how if we don't invest much, much more in fibre optic broadband, we're going to risk being frozen out of the next industrial revolution.
Now, our government has pledged to create the best superfast broadband network in Europe by 2015, with speeds of up to 24 megabits per second for 90% of UK households. That may seem okay, but the key word there is up to 24 megabits per second, which we already have, and it's rarely hitting 24 megabits per second unless you literally live next door to the exchange. Most of the time, I think people will find that they get between maybe 8 and 12 or 13 megabits per second, which is far slower than what Peter Cochrane wants.
Yeah, he said that we should be aiming for at least 100 megabits per second and planning for as much as 10 gigabits per second. He said 20 to 50 megabits per second will not give us entry to cloud computing, on which rests the next phase of industry, commerce, and a generation of GDP. So this pretty powerful words.
This is household, though. Now, I really wanted to talk about this because I do wonder, by 2015, whether 90% of households do need 100 megabits.
I don't think he's saying they need them by 2015, but what he was saying was that by aiming only for this by 2015, we would have to, if we then wanted to increase the bandwidth, we'd have to totally re-engineer the entire network. He's saying if we're going to be able to compete against Korea, like the Netherlands, China, Japan, we're going to need to really up our game and invest much, much more.
See, the argument for, I mean, say Virgin Media. I mean, Virgin Media's done well in investing in its network, and it's rolling out sort of 120 megabit broadband this year. And that makes sense in the home if you've got a big house, because for the average person, one single person using the internet, you don't need today 100 megabit internet connection necessarily.
No.
Where it comes into use is if you've got a big household and everyone is using, you know, cloud backup service here, online gaming system over
video
there.
Video conferencing.
Exactly. And particularly with the sort of push with, you know, streaming media services like Netflix, Apple TV, you know, you're downloading potentially several gigabytes a day and people are competing for that bandwidth in the home. But, you know, 10 gigabits per second, I mean, and by 2015, that's...
Yeah, he's not saying by 2015. He's saying we should be planning for 10 gigabits per second. We shouldn't just be, you know, limiting ourselves by planning for this kind of fairly low-hanging fruit, I guess. But one of the interesting things he suggested as well was to get someone like Ofcom to force the existing suppliers, so the Virgin Medias and the BTs of this world, to be able to kind of subcontract their unused fibre optics, so the dark fibre, as it's called.
They've got fibre that's basically underneath the street that has to be dug up and laid.
Yeah, so the biggest cost for installing fibre optic networks is digging up the street, stopping all the traffic, etc. And so this is really a big barrier to entry for new startups into this market. So if they could be allowed to kind of rent a bit of that fibre optic cable, they could then create small businesses that you know, repackaged and sold better broadband for customers.
And that's kind of what BT did for quite a long time and still does, is BT wholesale can sell out its network to other people who want to provide broadband. They want to basically just repackage BT service. And then a lot of people then started installing their own equipment in exchanges. And that's what people may have heard of, local loop unbundling.
Yeah.
That's when the kind of up to 24 meg people started really picking up steam, because they were able to use the copper network that BT had built, but they were able to put their own infrastructure inside BT's exchanges.
Yeah.
So I guess that's kind of similar to what we're talking about here for fiber optic, which, to be honest, makes a lot of sense. It certainly helped broadband competition in the UK heat up for the ADSL market,
yeah,
and it's probably the smart thing to do for the fiber optic market as well. I think that's an interesting side note. A few weeks ago, we talked about the St. Helena plans, which is St. Helena is a little island that has about 4,000 people, and they share one pathetic little, is it like 10 megabit microwave link internet connection?
Yeah.
And the argument is that the British government should help wire up this country with a fiber optic sea cable that would basically give them something like a 10 terabit internet connection, and which can have an effect on their economy. And there was a really interesting World Bank study in 2010 said that in low and middle income countries, every 10 percentage point increase in broadband penetration accelerates economic growth by 1.38 percentage points. Now, I don't think that the UK counts as a low income country, but it's certainly interesting as a side point to think that, you know, increasing penetration and speed of broadband can have a direct and measurable effect on the economy.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe it is a good thing to be pushing for these massive speeds.
Definitely. I mean, the slight issue is the cost. Cochrane suggests that we need to be spending $15 billion on this infrastructure as opposed to the existing $2.5 billion that's been pledged.
How much have you got in your pockets?
I've got any pockets.
No, I've got 11p.
I've got a key to the Wired test cupboard.
There's a lot of stuff in there. We can sell that. Well, have your say. podcast@wired.co.uk. Do you think 24 megabits per second is fast enough by 2015, or should we be pushing for 150 terabit connections to every computer in our house? Let us know. Staying on the topic of tech slightly, though, Seagate has envisioned 60 terabyte hard drives as being the next massive milestone in the next couple of decades, at least. The manufacturer has developed a new way, or rather has employed successfully a new way of cramming a trillion bits into a single square inch of hard disk space. And that could mean 3.5 inch hard disks, which are the kind that you get in your PC, that today could hold 4 terabytes, in a few years could store 6 terabytes, and then in the decade after that could store 60 terabytes.
So what does this mean? I mean, why would we be using these?
Well, there are two things that this means. There are two things that this means, rather. The first is that 60 terabytes on a hard disk is awesome. But the other thing, and because you can store more data, you know, but you're also increasing the, you know, you're putting all of your eggs in one basket, essentially. 60 terabytes of data on top of a single point of failure. It's not a great idea. Better still would be to put these in RAID arrays, where you're basically having 4 disks that mirror each other. But I think more interesting is the fact that, you know, as an industry, the, you know, PC industry is really moving towards flash memory. So the kind that we see in, say, the MacBook Air, it's not using hard drives. It's actually using flash chips, and the same type of flash memory that's used in mobile phones and tablet computers.
Why is that? What's the problem with these hard drives?
Well, hard drives, you know, the technology has been around for decades, and they are magnetic spinning platters with an arm that physically moves in and out of the disk to read and write data with magnets. And that, while it has proven to be the cheapest way to store massive amounts of data, it's easily damageable. They're heavy. They use more power. They're slower when it comes to seeking data on the disk. Flash memory, on the other hand, is much cooler, no moving parts, significantly faster.
Is that a solid state hard drive?
Yes, I mean, solid state, and the solid state drives you can get in bays that are the same size as a regular hard drive.
Yeah.
Whereas really what we're talking about here, that's flash memory, yeah. What we're talking about here is little flash chips. Mm. So rather than it being a hard drive full of flash memory, it's just little chips on a motherboard or something. So I find it interesting that we're in a position to talk about 60 terabyte hard drives. I just don't think we're ever going to see it. And I don't think if you had a 60 terabyte hard drive, you should use it at all.
Depends how much data you've got. If you create 60 terabytes a lot, maybe you need 4 of those and back them all up accordingly.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, let's go back to space, shall we, Liv? I want to know
back
how much...
space. Were we in space?
We were in space earlier when we were talking about the Pirate Bay drones, I suppose.
Well,
near low Earth orbit then.
Okay.
But this time we're going to go to Mars, and I know how much it's going to cost.
Yeah, it's going to cost just $500,000 per seat for a person to go to Mars, according to SpaceX's CEO, Elon Musk.
SpaceX being the private space firm that is part funded by NASA, that want to do commercial space flights as well as provide alternatives to the Russian Soyuz rockets,
for
example.
And you might think that $500,000 or £315,000 per seat is quite a lot. However, this is a bargain price and is about 1% of the cost that NASA currently pays to send a person to the space station on a Russian Soyuz... How do you say that word?
Soyuz.
Soyuz rocket.
That's how I say it. I don't know if it's how they say it. They say it with an accent. Yeah, it costs... I think it's like $50 million to send one man to the space station.
Yeah.
50 million.
Yeah.
Per head.
It's a huge amount of money.
That's almost as much as Virgin Trains charges to go to Manchester.
And that's
from
only
London.
To the space station as well, not Mars. And Musk, SpaceX hasn't been entirely clear about how they're going to achieve that price, but did admit that it would take a while to get down to that, probably 10 years after the trips had initially started. And he said the way that you'd be able to do that would be to have the ability to refuel on Mars and also reuse the spacecraft over and over again, as we do with aeroplanes.
Yeah.
But the details are pretty patchy at this stage. We're told we can expect more of the details in less than a year.
Less than a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see, I don't know. I'm really excited by the whole SpaceX thing. I think that private spaceflight is obviously where we're going. I mean, the shuttles have been decommissioned now, so it's basically either Russian Soyuz rocket or private.
But that's the sort of ambition we need for our broadband, isn't it?
Well, it's the sort of ambition we need for the European Space Agency.
True.
I mean, this is SpaceX. We're not getting any of that money. I think we should have a European solution that offers a competitive rate. I mean, that's basically what Virgin Galactic wants to do, but for tourism. But I think, you know, if they could make a successful business off the back of space tourism, and that's like, what, £200,000 just to go into...
But it's not even...
It's not space. It's not space technically, but you know, if they could make that a profitable business, then could you imagine, you know, Virgin Mars?
Yeah, I'd be up for that.
Richard Branson, you know, replacing fuel on the International Space Station. Although that's only got funding till like 2020, actually. So
yeah,
that'll be success succeeded before too long. Maybe by Virgin. Who knows? All right, well, we've got one last quick story I want to get to before we finish the show, which is that Angry Birds Space has come out. And I wanted to talk about this very briefly, purely because we haven't talked about any games today, Liv. How excited are you about Angry Birds Space?
I was more excited about the viral video where they got an astronaut to play it on the International Space Station.
Oh, they did.
I can't remember what the guy was called. It was a US astronaut. And I was absolutely like staggered that they managed to achieve that.
Yeah, that was about a week ago, I think, maybe just over. But the Angry Birds Space thing is quite cool because it's out today on the usual platforms, iPhone, Android, things like that. But they've kind of, the whole thing about Angry Birds before now is that they made this success from using, you know, Earth-based physics to blow buildings into the ground. And now they've gone into space where there's no gravity. So you have to take advantage of a completely new way of flinging birds into pigs, like having to fire in the vicinity of a planet, so you can take advantage of that planet's gravitational pull.
That's awesome.
You know, which is actually the same sort of physics, very loosely speaking, that, you know, NASA will use to sort of you know, piggyback off the orbit of the gravity of Jupiter to sort of use it as kind of a gravitational slingshot out to Pluto or something. So kind of interesting.
Really interesting. Have you played it yet?
I haven't, because I've been far too busy working and, you know, producing podcasts. But we have got a piece on the website. But to be perfectly honest, I don't think anyone's going to go and read that now. That's going to go and download it. It's on sale. Annoyingly, it's on sale. 69p on the iPhone, and it's like £2 on the iPad. It's the same damn game.
Oh, but just think of how much better it'll look.
Yeah, it will look better. But anyway, that, Liv, is the end of our show.
Very sad.
We're finished. We don't have a feature this week. We don't have a Duncan this week. But all...
We do have hooves, though.
We do have hooves. And we'll be back next week with hooves. Same hooves. Duncan. Maybe a feature. Depends. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch to tell us how excited they are.
There are many ways they can get in touch. The first is by calling us on our magical Skype phone. You just give us a call on 0208 123 0468.
You can call us from a landline as well. And a mobile, if you wish.
Yes, both of those work perfectly well. Or just call Wired UK Podcast on Skype for free.
It's an answer phone, so you don't worry, you don't have to talk to us.
No, just 30 seconds. That's after that, just we're going to get bored and stop listening.
Yep.
But then you can also follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. And on Facebook, we are facebook.com/WiredUK.
Yep, and send us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. We will be galloping back next week with a full... stable, full of fun and information. And until then, continue to be excellent to each other.
Nee.
It's...
You like those?
It's the future of swallowing.